My name is Bobby, and I'm a very grateful alcoholic. My sobriety date is December the 15th, 1998. I have a home group, the Central Group in Tallahassee, and I have a couple of sponsors. I'm so glad to be here. I want to thank the committee of the Marietta Spring Roundup, the 24th Marietta Spring Roundup. I really want to thank the committee for asking me. And I want to thank everybody who was involved in having me attend this roundup. It has been awesome, absolutely wonderful. And Judy was saying, how did I get to know her? The big book says, each day, somewhere in the world, somewhere in the world, and we are somewhere in the world. Recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another alcoholic, sharing experience, strength, and hope. And she was sharing her experience, strength, and hope with me, and I was sharing mine back to her. And it was like we connected. It was a heart-to-heart conversation. And I really want to thank you for hosting today. You've done an excellent job. You've been an excellent host. And I just feel so at home. I can't stand here and tell you that I'm not nervous because I'd be lying. I am nervous. But before I get started in my story, I want to read something from the big book on page 50. It says, in our personal stories, you will find a wide variation in the way each teller approaches and conceives of a power which is greater than himself. Whether we agree with a particular approach or conception seems to make little difference. Experience has taught us that these are matters about which, for our purpose, we need not be worried. They are questions for each individual to settle for himself. And that spoke to me. I was telling my sponsor, who's here tonight, who came to Tallahassee this week to visit me, and she had to leave early because she had to be back to Atlanta for something she had to do. But as we were visiting in Tallahassee, I said to her, I'm very nervous about speaking, and I get nervous every time I speak. And she said, all you have to do is tell the truth. So I got up the next morning when God woke me up at 4:30, and every morning when he wakes me up at 4:30, I do my morning devotion. So I was in the bathroom on my knees, and I was telling God that I was nervous. And the message that I received was, Bobby, it's your story. It's the only one you have. The reason you are nervous, you have not accepted it. You have to accept your story. That's your story. So tonight I stand here to tell you that I accept my story. Only I can tell my story. And I'm here tonight to tell you in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like now. I can say a line that comes directly out of the big book that fits me, and it's on page 544. I don't know all the pages, but I carry my big book with me everywhere I go because I might not remember everything that's in it, but I know this book saved my life. And that page tells me that the mental twist that started me drinking began many, many years before I ever picked up a drink. And that is so true. Something been wrong with me from my earliest recollection. I remember sitting at our dining room table when I was 5 or 6 years old. And we had a long dining room table because it was 9 kids and my mom and dad. So the table was pretty long with all of us kids. And we were getting ready to eat, and my dad would say, I want each one of you all to say a Bible verse before dinner. And we would say a Bible verse, and I hated that. I hated every minute of that. So when it got to me, I would say, Jesus wept. Because I was so angry, I didn't want to say anything, but I remembered the shortest Bible verse in the Bible. And we would say our Bible verses, and then my dad would pray. And he would pray this long prayer. And I would be sitting there, and I would be mumbling up under my breath, I'll be glad when I leave here. I'm sick of these crazy people. And all we were doing was praying. I couldn't stand nothing about prayer. Nothing. We were made to go to church. I didn't want to go to church. I didn't want to participate in Sunday school. I didn't want to do none of that. I just hated every minute of it. I just hated being disciplined. I had a traumatic experience happen to me when I was 8 years old. When I was 8 years old, my mother just suddenly came home one day and she said, "I'm leaving." And she packed her clothes in pillowcases, whatever she, grocery bags, whatever she could put things in, she put all of her belongings in, and she left. She took off. But let me back up a little bit. What I've learned about my mother was only 14 years old when I was born. She was 14. And what I learned that my mother had no place to live when she was pregnant with me. And the man that picked her up and took her home when she was pregnant with me is the man that I call Dad. And she was sitting on a church on the steps. And this family in Tallahassee saw her sitting on the church steps pregnant. And the mom of the man I called Dad took her home. And then while she was in these people's house, my dad, being 21, he married her. And shortly after that, I was born. And she already had a son 2 years older than me, so she must have been 12 when he was born. See, I know nothing about my family, but I'm from a family that people just didn't want. The family connection just isn't there. And I grew up in that, and I was very sad. And then I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, and being very sad and very ashamed of my past, I didn't want to tell nobody that, and that kind of stuff kept me drunk. So right after my mother left, my daddy brought us to Tallahassee, Florida, to live with his mother. And I just remember just going from place to place. And when he dumped us on my grandmother, my dad would not support us. So my grandmother went to court trying to get support. So they arrested my daddy, because he wouldn't support us. And right after they arrested him, he came to Tallahassee and got us and then moved us back to Central Florida. So, and right after that, he got married, and I had a stepmother. Ooh, I didn't like a stepmother. I did everything I could to try to keep my dad from marrying this woman. I said to her, "Dad, please don't marry her. I'm 12 years old now. I can do anything that you would want her to do. I can do it." And my dad said, "No, you need a mother. I'm going to marry her because you need a mother." And he married this woman. So, and that's when I picked up my first drink. My dad sold moonshine. But what I noticed about my dad selling moonshine to all of our neighbors was he wouldn't drink it. He wouldn't drink his own moonshine. My dad would go to the liquor store and buy half-pint bottles of Gordon's gin, lots of them. So he kept a dresser drawer in his room filled with half-pint bottles of Gordon's gin. And I'm being the oldest of my sisters and brothers and my stepsisters and brothers. I was responsible for keeping the house clean. As we call it in AA, control. I was in control. And I brought that attitude into Alcoholics Anonymous for a long, long time because I was really in control. So they put me in charge of doing everything in the house. So when I got to my dad and my stepmother slept in separate bedrooms. So when I got to my father's bedroom, I was in heaven because I opened that drawer and I got me a half-pint bottle of gin, and I remember it to this day. I twist the cap, and I can still hear that paper rattling. And I took the bottle and I turned it up to my mouth and I went glunk, a glunk, a glunk. It seemed like my head just split open. And I had that warm feeling go down, and my first thought was, "I don't give a damn." And it made everything that I thought wrong with them right. Everything got all right as long as I was drinking, and that was my first drink. And I drank like a fish from then on. My mother was a drinker. My mother was a drinker and a men-nizer. I remember my mother having lots of boyfriends before she separated from my dad. And I vowed. Seeing my mother drunk was the worst picture I'd ever seen in my life. And I thought, there's nothing worse than an alcoholic drunk woman. And I became one. And I swore to God that I would never be my mother. And I ended up worse than my mother. I lived with my grandmother for a while. My grandmother put us in school in Tallahassee. And I remember I didn't care nothing about school. I didn't care nothing about anything if it didn't involve drinking. But she put us in school, and the funny thing about being in school at that young age, I was in a lower grade, and my brother caught up with me. He was in the same grade I was in. And I didn't like that. I didn't want my brother to be in the same grade with me. I wanted to do something about that, but there was nothing I could do. And I didn't care about studying. I just didn't care about school. If it didn't involve drinking, I wanted no part of it. But anyway, when my dad was arrested, he came to get us from living with my grandmother and drove us back to Central Florida. And we stayed with this stepmom. And I thought of everything I could do to get away from the house. I was promiscuous. I was doing things that 12-year-olds wouldn't do. So my dad would tell us to go to bed a certain time of night, and I would get out the window. I would get out the window and go hang with teenagers that were drinking at teenage places and drinking Boom Farm wine and doing all kinds of crazy stuff that little girls are not supposed to do. Also, when I was 12 years old, my father enticed me. My stepmother was at the hairdresser one day getting her hair done. So my father was home by himself, he and I. So my father said, "Bobby Jean, I want you to come in the house." I remember sitting on the back porch drying my hair by the sunshine. So I went in the house, and he had a pistol, and he forced me to have sex with him. That was another traumatic thing that happened when I was 12. And I just thought I was the worst person in the world. I would bathe and bathe and try to clean myself, but I could never get that feeling out of my mind. And I would just drink and drink and do all kind of promiscuous things, trying to get that feeling to go away, and it never went away. And this happened at 12. And I had the feeling that all a woman had to do was be independent, independent of men, just learn how to take care of myself and be independent. And you don't need an education for that. So I had heard or read, I think I read a book by Xavier Hollander called The Happy Hooker. And I don't know when I read that book, but I remember reading that book. And I thought, I'm going to be a happy hooker. And I set out to be a happy hooker. I remember when I was pregnant and my stepmother persuaded my father to put me out because my father had married a woman who had been a preacher's wife and her husband had died and she was very religious. I wouldn't say spiritual. She was a very religious, phony religious woman. But anyway, my father put me out, and I went to live with my grandmother and my grandmother wanted no parts of me because I was the wild child. My grandmother said, "Bobby Jean, there's something wrong with you. You are very peculiar." And people are still calling me peculiar. But I know that peculiarity is alcoholism. I have a deep, chronic, complex psychological and nutritional disorder associated with compulsive, impulsive behavior. And I still have that. They have not gone any place. I just stopped drinking. But I have 12 steps to learn how to keep that in check. Anyway, I became the happy hooker. I moved out west. And I remember I wanted to set up a house of prostitution, and I didn't know quite how to do it. So I got a job working in a bar at first. And I'm working in a bar in Indiana, and first I got a job as a prostitute. A man hired me as a prostitute, and I didn't know anything about what I was doing. All I know, he went out and he bought me pretty clothes, and he was telling me some things to do to these men. And I'm making all these money because men just kept coming and I'm making a lot of money. But when I would make all this money, the pimp or whatever you call him, he would come and get the money. Then I thought one day, I'm not going to do all this hard work and have someone come and get my money. Not me. Not me. So how, So how can I leave here? So I wanted to leave him. So one night in the middle of the night in Indiana, I got up and I left. And I walked the street all night trying to find a place to go. And I had no place to go. So a man was opening his bar early in the morning. So I went in the bar. He still had the chairs on the table. He was cleaning up, getting ready for the day. So I went in and I sat down. And he said, "What can I do for you, young lady?" And I said, "Please make me a pink lady." He said, "I don't know how to make pink ladies. Do you know how to make them?" And I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Well, come behind the counter and make your own pink lady." I thought I was in seventh heaven. I went behind the counter, and I proceeded to make myself a pink lady. And I told him he didn't have eggs because I needed some egg whites. So he said, "Get some money off the cash register and run across the street and get a half dozen eggs." And I did. And I came back, and I put it in the shaker, and it was real pretty and foamy. And he sat with me, and he said, "Who are you?" And I told him who I was and why I was running away. And he said, "You don't have to run any longer. If you know how to make a pink lady, I want you to work for me." And I got a job then and there in that bar as a barmaid. This man who owned the bar, he put me in charge of everything shortly after I was there. I was in charge of the hiring and firing. I was in charge of the go-go girls. I was in charge of everything. I was in charge of ordering liquor for the bar. And when the day the salesman would come to bring liquor for the bar, I would order just as much liquor for my apartment. Because the owner of the bar by this time had put me up in an apartment. And you all know the rest of the story. The owner of the bar and I were having an affair. All kinds of stuff was going on. So I started working in this bar, and I was doing really, really good, really good. But I thought I was drinking and drinking and drinking. And I'm drinking and serving customers, and I would think people sitting on the bar was talking about me because by now I'm hearing voices, and I don't know what's going on. And I would look at a couple in the bar, and I would think they were talking about me, and I would come from behind the bar with my little mini thing on, and I would walk up to the customer, and I would say, "Bitch, what did you say about me?" And she would say, "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't even know you." And then I would be so embarrassed because I heard all these voices going on. And I'm talking back to the voices, but I'm talking at people. And one night from this particular bar, I pulled off all my clothes and I went streaking down the road, just streaking butt naked. So they threw me in the back seat of a police car, put an army blanket over me, and took me to jail. I woke up in a treatment center, and they had given me shock treatment. By now, the owner of the bar is coming to visit me in the alcoholic place, and he's bringing me chocolates and pretty nightgowns to wear. I didn't connect anything with alcoholism. But I knew when I got out of the hospital, I couldn't go back to the bar because it was the people in the bar doing that to me. So I thought, I can't go back there, so I'm going to open a house of prostitution. And that's what I did. I got a duplex in Indiana, and I lived on one side, and I hired a lot of girls because I knew a lot of girls that worked in prostitution. So I hired some of these women to come work for me. And this went on for a few years, and I'm making money hand over fist at the madam of a house. Then the policeman started to raid my house. The policeman would come there dressed as ordinary people. And I thought, I'm always thinking, how can I beat this? Because I got to be one step ahead of people trying to do, because I thought everybody was out to get me. So I hired a bail bondsman in case I went to jail. I had somebody to come get me right out. But anyway, I'm operating this house of prostitution. And they would sit and look at my house in binoculars and do all kind of things. I had my backyard gravel so all the cars could park in the backyard. I lived on a street, a very nice street in Indiana. No black people lived on my street. And I'm there running a house of prostitution. So you can imagine what the neighbors thought. I don't even have to go there. But I'm making all of this money, and then I'm going one time I got arrested, and I called my bail bondsman, he came and got me, and I had to go to court, and I went before a judge, and judges were my clients. I bet every judge in this little town in Indiana was a client of mine. So I went before this judge with my little micro mini on and thinking I'm hot stuff. And he said, "Do you know what you are here for?" And I said, "I know what they have accused me of being here for." And I had an alias name, and he called me by my alias, and he said, "Go have a seat. Go sit in your seat, and I'll call you back up later." But see, the judge and I had a thing. This judge was a freak. And he just liked to see me walk. So I would do that little special walk back to my seat. I mean, we women alcoholics know the game. If you're an alcoholic woman like me, and I would do this little special walk back to my seat, and he would call me by my alias, and he would say, "Come back up here." So by the time I got back up there, he had done his number behind the desk. If any judges in the house, no offense. So when I walked back up there, he said, "Case dismissed." So here I am again thinking I've gotten over. I have beat the rap. So I went before a judge. I got busted another time, still running the house, making a lot of money, paying my girls well, doing everything what I thought was right, because I thought all a woman had to do was make a lot of money and become really independent. And I was really independent of men. I have learned that I didn't like men. That's why I was doing that. I never liked men. And I was doing everything to try to get back at my father. The man who I call father, I later learned that he's not my father. But I was doing all this stuff to get back at people and hurting, killing myself. So I got arrested again in this little town and went before a judge. And this judge was not a client of mine. And he read my rap sheet and he said, "You have been in this court many, many times. And I really want to send you away for a long time because you're a menace to society." He said those words to me. And I didn't know what to do, but I thought if he let me go, I would not do prostitution again. And he did let me go. And I had read somewhere that a woman could go to New York and get a job as a nanny. So I said, "That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to answer one of these ads in the paper, and I'm going to New York and get a job as from a prostitute to a nanny." Can you imagine? So some woman in New York, I answered her advertisement, and she called me, and she wanted me to come to Rye, New York, to meet her and her lawyer husband. And I went to Rye, and she was a lawyer, and her husband was a lawyer, and she had had triplets, three babies. And she put me in charge of taking care of these three little babies. And these babies would cry all the time. And I don't like children. I was blessed with two, and I don't know. But anyway, these babies would cry. And this lady had lots of booze, very plush house in Rye, New York, very plush. And she had a booze. She had lots of booze in her bar. And I remember drinking every drop of liquor she had in her bar, and I felt if it was red whiskey, I made a little tea and made it just the color it was. If it was white, I filled it up with water. And she got a whiff of that, and she called her husband, saying, and I heard her whispering to her husband that they had to get rid of me. So he came to me one day and was telling me that I had to go and blah, blah, blah. And I had my little spear for him because he knew what we were doing. So if I had to go somewhere, he had to put me up just like he was putting her up. So he got me a place to live in Port Chester, New York, right out of Rye. And in this little place that the lawyer got me to live, and he paying all my expenses, and I'm drinking in my accustomed style. I'm just drinking all day and all night, just drinking, drinking, drinking. And I had DTs. I started seeing white German shepherds. I couldn't open my closet because a white German shepherd would jump out at me and I would fall on the floor. And I started seeing snakes crawling and lizards and all kinds of things were crawling over my body and I'm running and screaming. And somebody called the police and had me put in the hospital from Port Chester. I remember waking up in the hospital
And I didn't know what to do. I talked to a social worker in Port Chester, New York, and I said, I don't know what's happening to me, but I can't go back to Port Chester. It's the people in Port Chester. Please send me to another town. So she put me in an apartment in White Plains, New York. And I hate to remember this stuff. But in White Plains, New York, I remember I got a job working for AT&T. It would have been a good job if I could have kept it. But alcohol, everything that I tried to do with my life, alcohol robbed me of it. And the big book talks about that. It said an illness of this sort, and we have become to believe it an illness, annihilates us from everything worthwhile in life. And I've had some worthwhile things, but alcohol has robbed me of them. So I worked for AT&T for a little while, and I'm drinking around the clock. I'm drinking on the job by now. When you work for AT&T, back when I did, they give you a locker room so you put your things, and I was a switchboard operator. And I had a locker room, and I remember filling my locker room up with liquor, just like my dad had his drawer filled with liquor bottles. And on my break, I would go to the locker room and just drink liquor on my breaks, just drink, 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 and be at work. And what separated me from that job was, I'm drunk at the switchboard one day, and it was a man in jail trying to call his boss in the South, and his boss wouldn't accept the call. And I'm sitting at my place at the switchboard, and I'm saying to the boss, because I can hear the conversation, I say, yes, you are going to accept this call, too, because I'm going to put him through. In control. I'm always in authority. So I put the man through that wanted to talk to his boss, and right after they got through talking, my supervisor came to my station, and she said, you no longer have a job. And she fired me right there on the spot. So I lost that job for AT&T. Then I go home, and I'm drinking around the clock. By this time, I have a house in White Plains, New York, but I can't afford to pay all of the rent by myself, so I have a roommate. So my roommate, Ruby, see me drinking. I'm drinking liquor. I have the cabinets full of liquor, and I'm just guzzling out of the bar. So she called me one day, and she said, Bobby, there's something wrong with the way you drink. The way you drink, I need you to go to a doctor. I wasn't ready then. I wasn't ready that day, and I kept drinking. But later on, the DTs had started to come back again, so I said, Ruby, I want to go to your doctor. So we called a doctor in White Plains, New York, and I sat in this doctor's office, and I told him, he said, tell me about your drinking. And I said, which part? But anyway, I told him enough of my story where he said, and the first time I ever heard these words, doctor said, you are an alcoholic. I said, what is that? He said, it's a person that drink like you say you drink. And I said, okay, if you say that, what am I to do about it? And he said, you should go to Alcoholics Anonymous, and this was in 1971. And I told you my sobriety date is December 15, 1998. He said, for a person that drink like you say you drink, you should go to AA. And I had never heard of AA, never in my life. So he picked up the phone, and he dialed AA, and he handed me the phone. And I'm listening to it ring. And the lady said, hello, my name is Mary Ann, and I'm an alcoholic. I laughed my ass off. And I said to the doctor, I said, what in the hell is she telling me she's an alcoholic for? I don't care nothing about that. And he said, listen to her. Tell her you're an alcoholic too. I said, listen, Mary Ann, I'm sitting in Dr. So-and-so's office, and he told me to tell you I'm an alcoholic. So she said, okay, why don't you come to the meeting right down the street? It was right down the street in a church. And I asked her what time. She told me what time. So I left the doctor's office and went to my first AA meeting. The AA meeting was in a basement of a church. And all these old white women. Old. And I'm 27 years old. So I sat there for a little bit, and one woman say, I hid liquor in the back of the commode. And I said, why the hell would you do that? I've never had to hide liquor in my life. I drank freely. And one lady said, my husband left me because of drinking. And I said, who would care anything about that? All these men in the world, when one leaves, get another one. So you see, I was not identifying, in no way I was comparing. And that kept me drunk for the next 27 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. In and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I went and compared. I never identified. And I stayed drunk. I stayed drunk for 27 years. And I keep saying that to remind myself, in and out of AA. So I'm going to skip over a whole lot of stuff that I don't think is pertinent to this meeting. So when I was 54 years old, I had been everywhere in the United States I wanted to go, done everything that I was big enough to do, legal and illegal. I have done my spiel. So when I was 54 years old, I came to another AA meeting after a whole lot had happened to me. I got a DUI. I had been to meetings for 27 years and had never gotten a DUI. And I had heard men at an AA meeting say, I have 5 DUIs. I have 10 DUIs. And I said, that will never happen to me. So I got a DUI and I went to AA in Atlanta. I'm in Atlanta by now. And I'm 54 years old. And I'm sitting in a meeting, just got out of jail. My last drunk was December 14th, 1998. I remember waking up December 14th, 1998, going to the bank, getting $1,000. Because December 14th is one of my son's birthday. And my son at that time lived in Dunwoody. And I said, I'm going to call my oldest son, and I'm going to light up Atlanta. So I called him December the 14th, and Greg and I went out, and I can't tell you nothing what happened that day, because I think I was in a blackout from going to the bank from the start. All I know, I woke up in Fulton County Jail, in East Point, in jail in East Point. I woke up in East Point Jail. And I don't know much about that night, and I had no money. And to this day, I accuse my son of taking my money. I don't know where that money went, but I woke up in East Point Jail. December the 15th, I got out because I knew about AA. And there was a sign in all AA meetings that I went to at the time, had a sign over the door saying, keep coming back. And I'm so grateful for that sign. Because no matter how much I drank during that period when I couldn't stay sober, I kept going back to AA. And I'm so grateful that to God for letting me live. Because God didn't have to let me live through all of that, but God let me live through all of that. And when I was sitting in a meeting about my third day out of jail, I was sitting in the Tower Club in Southwest Atlanta, and I knew sitting in that meeting that day that I was going to drink again if I didn't ask for help. So I walked up to a woman, and you know, Atlanta is strange. This was an all-black meeting. And I heard black women say, I got 15 years. I got 20 years. I got 30. But I knew for me at the time that I could not get a black woman to sponsor me because I'm a bullshitter. And I can bullshit the best of people. So this woman was there, one white woman in an all-black meeting. And something said to me, and I choose to call that something God, go up and ask her to be your sponsor. And I say, not me. I don't like white people. And that voice said it again in a very calm way. Bobby, ask her to be your sponsor. You're going to be drunk before sundown. And she spoke, and when she spoke, sounded to me like she was walking on water. And I wanted what she had just by listening to her speak. So I walked up to her, and I put my hands on my hips, and I said, Miss Attitude. Somebody call me Miss Attitude. If you're not sponsoring too many people, will you sponsor me? And she said, look, it's none of your business how many people I'm sponsoring. But if you want me to help you, I'll help you. And I'm standing in front of her. So she reached in her purse, and she took out a card, and she wrote her name and phone number on the back, and she put the card on the table. And I'm standing right in front of her. And because she didn't put the card in my hand, I looked at her and I said, you bitch. She said, pick up that card and do what it says. I know today that that was my first assignment, was to pick up that card off the table. So I picked up that card and I went home and I ran upstairs and downstairs. Because you see, I wanted to drink. and I was restless, irritable, and discontent. I didn't know what to do with myself. And I'm running up and down stairs, and something said to me, Bobby, you have a card in your pocketbook. Call that number. So I called that number, and I've been calling that number ever since. And I told this woman how I wanted to drink, and I told her what I wanted to drink, and I told her where the liquor store was, and I told her I had my own money. And she said, but if you don't have to do that if you do this. So she gave me something precise to do, and I did what she said that day, and it kept me from drinking. So she said, I want you to go to a meeting every day unless I call you and ask you to read a chapter in the big book. So she called me one day, and she said, I don't want you to go to a meeting today. And I just love to go to meetings brand new and run my mouth. And she said, I don't want you to go to a meeting today. I want you to stay home and read more about alcoholism, page 30 to page 43. And she's telling me this, and my head is going, no, you don't. I don't want to do that. So I called her back, and I said, Bobby, I don't want to read those pages. She said, I don't want you to do them because you want to. I want you to do them because I ask you to. And then I really got an attitude. Nobody tells me what to do. So she said, not only do I want you to read those pages, Bobby, I want you to read them and then call me back and let me know what you learned. Now, that was a kicker because I love to think I know stuff. So I read the pages. I read the pages, and I called her back and told her what I thought I had learned. And she said, that chapter says nothing about drinking. I said, yes, it does, right in the first paragraph. She said, Bobby, it's more about alcoholism. Do you know what alcoholism means? Have you learned anything about alcoholism? And I said, no. She said, first of all, I want you to look up the definition of alcoholism. And that's why I know what that definition is today. It's a deep, chronic, complex, psychological, and nutritional disorder associated with compulsive, impulsive behavior. And I have compulsive, impulsive behavior, not drinking, because I have a psychological disorder. And the whole chapter more about alcoholism is about a psychological disorder. It's about thinking. And she said, I want you to read it again. And everywhere it says drinking, I want you to put thinking. And everywhere it says drink, I want you to put think. I want you to write it right over the word. And I read it with the think and the drinking, and then it made sense to me. It said, try some control thinking. try to control your thinking. Try to start thinking and stop thinking abruptly. I tried that the other day when I wanted to go shopping at Macy's. My mind said, Bobby, don't go to Macy's. And I said, I'm not going to spend but about two or three, you know, not much. So I went to Macy's and spent $389. I threw that stuff on the back seat of my car, and I was mad because I was riding that stuff around in my car. And I called my sponsor, and she said, take it back. I said, uh-huh. She said, well, if you're not going to take it back, don't complain. So I learned that the whole program of Alcoholics Anonymous is not about drinking. It's about thinking. That's why that line is in the big book, so we shall strive. The mental twists that precede a relapse into drinking. You talk about the mental first. And that's why my sponsor said, call her every day to let her know what I was thinking. Because anytime I'm going to drink, I'm going to think first. And I'm going to think about a whole lot of stuff before I get the drink. So that put me in touch with the first step. The first step said we admitted we were powerless over thinking. My thinking makes my life unmanageable. My thinking will make your life unmanageable, too, if you listen to me. So I got in touch with me by working the 12 steps. The second step, they came to believe that a power greater than me could relieve me of my sick thinking. I got a psychotic mind. I'm psychotic. I'm a really psychotic person. But I believe that a power greater than me can transform my thinking. And the big book tells me that on page 143. It said, first, Bobby, you need a change of heart. That's why I have to pray a lot. And I say, God, come into my heart and change my heart. Because if you change my heart, which is 18 inches from the head, then my head will get better. So when my heart changes, my thinking changes. And when my thinking changes, my attitude changes. And when my attitude changes, my conduct changes. And I'm a better person because of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I've been sober for 15 years, and there hasn't been a day in 15 years that I haven't had a first, second, or third step experience. Every day of my life, I have a first, second, and third step experience, and it has nothing to do with alcohol. It's all this crazes. My sponsor also would say when I go to meetings to call her when I leave the meeting and let her know what I learned from the meeting and don't talk. She said, don't talk because you think you know something and you don't know anything, so don't say a thing. So I would call her and tell her what I learned from the meeting, and I didn't like people. I find I didn't like people. And if the same lady shared all the time, I would call my sponsor and talk about this woman that shared all this shit. And my sponsor got me through that. She said, keep the focus on you. I didn't have no focus. My focus was always on you. I was always outside of myself. But the steps taught me, especially when I did my fourth step, it taught me how to keep the focus on me. I found that I was very, very angry when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had so many resentments. Resentment, fears, and sex. Those are the dominating factors. I oftentimes say that not only was I addicted to alcohol, I'm addicted to resentment, I'm addicted to fears, and I'm darn sure addicted to sex. And when I get all of them wrapped up together, I'm a crazy person. I'm insane. I am insane. But the steps, working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, initially with a sponsor, all 12 steps with a sponsor, and she showed me. Because the big book says on page 56, it says, leaving aside the drink problem. I wasn't drinking. I was telling my sponsor why my life was so unsatisfactory. Why all these people just kept making my life unsatisfactory. Then my sponsor showed me, and it tells me on that page that they would show me how this program worked for them. And I knew my sponsor had a lot of difficulties in her life, and she was going through a lot of trials, and she was not drinking. And then I thought one day, if she can go through this shit and not drink, I can too. Because she had some difficult trials and tribulations. And I'm thinking, how do you surmount all that stuff and not drink? But my sponsor showed me how this program worked. She showed me how she practiced the steps in her life. When she had a character defect, she would call me and say, Barbara, this character defect is acting in my life, but I'm going to redouble my efforts with AA. Come to Griffin, Georgia, and go to a meeting with me. She was living in Mara then. Let's go to a meeting together in Mara. And I did a lot of things with my sponsor. My sponsor went to a lot of grape-a-thons. We don't have those in Tallahassee. But she went to a lot of grape-a-thons. She went to a lot of conventions. She went to a lot of roundups. And wherever she went, she was sponsoring about 8 of us at the time. And she would take all of us. No, I wouldn't say she would take us with her. She wouldn't literally put us in her car. But she would say, come go with me. And we had to caravan. We had to follow my sponsor because my sponsor didn't believe riding a whole lot of people in her car. And that was just my sponsor. And we would caravan to places like this, and Bobby would get all 8 of us there, and the AA people would say, there go, her name is Bobby. Some of you might know her. And the people might say, there go Bobby and her girls. And that would just tick me off because I own the harem. I wasn't no girl of Bobby. I was my own girl. And Bobby would say, "You sit here, and you sit here, and you sit here." I'd say, "Damn." But I needed that kind of discipline. I was hard-headed. I was obstinate. I was stubborn. I was disobedient. I was undisciplined because I had never done nothing a woman told me to do in my life, not my grandmother or my mother who was not there. And I finally got a woman in AA to give me some guidance, to give me some leadership, to show me how this program works, and to put me on the fourth step and tell me it was six columns instead of the three in the book, and showed me where those six columns are in the big book. And I have worked my step that way. And then I went to the sixth step. And I can't say you just work the steps and say, "Well, I'm going to do the sixth step now." Something has to happen in my life to let me know that I'm ready for a sixth step. And the biggest thing that happened to me, is it time for me to quit? The biggest thing that happened to me was I couldn't stop stealing. I was a thief. And that was my basic trouble. I'm a liar, a thief, and a cheat. And one day I was at my sponsor's house, my sponsor sat here, and she had a party. And she had some spare ribs on the grill. So I went to her, and I said, "Can I have a slab of those, not a slab, enough spare ribs off the grill to make a sandwich to take home for lunch next day?" She said, "Oh, sure." So I go switching out to her grill in my little shorts and the grill master cooking. And I said, "When that slab get done, put it on this aluminum foil." The grill master said, "The whole slab?" I said, "The whole slab." But my mind said, "You have only asked her for a sandwich." I said, "But I'm going to take a whole slab." So you talk back to that alcoholic voice. So I took a whole slab of my sponsor's spare ribs when I had asked for a sandwich. So that was Sunday. The next day being Monday, I get up to go to my refrigerator to make me a barbecue sandwich. Then my Holy Spirit says, "Bobby, you stole a slab of Avery's spare ribs." I'm sorry. "You stole a slab of your sponsor's spare ribs." And then I felt so guilty because I asked for a sandwich. And I got on the phone and I called her and I said, "I asked you for a sandwich and I took a whole slab." She said, "I know you did." And I said, "How do you know?" She said, "I was looking at you at my kitchen window." And I said, "Why didn't you say something about it?" She said, "It wasn't my place to say anything. It was your place to do what you're doing right now." And I said, "What should I do about it? Do you want me to pay you for this?" She said, "No, you're doing what you're supposed to do. You're telling on your disease." And then I was able to see that I am a thief. And at that point, I became entirely ready for God to relieve stealing from me. And although becoming ready, he didn't relieve it. And this is the biggie. And I'm going to say this, and I'm going to sit down. I just want to show you that this program works in my life. I had the opportunity to go to the Monastery of the Holy Spirit back in this summer. And I'm just as sober back in the summer as I am right now. And I was in the Monastery of the Holy Spirit in Conyers, New York, on a retreat. And I'm in this retreat. We get up 4 o'clock in the morning and go to the Mass and do all this stuff that Catholics do. I'm not Catholic. But I love being in this monastery. There was something about this monastery that was very spiritual. So I go to the monastery, and I'm leaving the altar. And then people throwing money on the table. So I hesitate. I said, "They're throwing money on. I mean, they just throwing wads of money." I said, So I reach in there, I get some money, I put it in my pocket. And I go to workshops all the next, that same day. So I'm in a workshop, and I say to one of the priests, I say, "How do we forgive ourselves? I got this money in my pocket. I want to say so bad in front of the whole class, I got the money in my pocket. But there's just some things you just don't do." So the priest, who is very familiar with AA, he said, "Bobby, this was our course. We realized that people who wronged us was perhaps spiritually sick." And he said, "Sometimes you wrong yourself. If you're wrong..." wrong yourself, you are spiritually sick. And I'm thinking about the money I got in my pocket. I had done a terribly wrong to myself. And he said, you have to show yourself compassion. You have to have love for yourself. You have to have patience. You have to have tolerance. Because you have all of those things for other people. Have those things for you, too. And when you can have those things for you, then you can forgive yourself. And I said, holy shit, I never heard that before. So I'm walking around with this money in my pocket, not much money, just a $20 bill I had taken off the table. I'm thinking it's $100, but when I looked at it, it was a $20. And I really, really want to take the money back and put it where I got it from. So I'm all day. So it becomes late that evening. It's time for me to go to my room. And I said, instead of me going to my room, I'm going to go right downstairs in the cathedral. So as I walked in the big cathedral, there's nobody in there. The doors are very hard to open. So I pull the door open, walk in, and I walk before this big statue that everybody bows to. So I bow to the statue, the money in my pocket. Then I walk back and put the money right where I had gotten it from. Then I walk back to the statue and I bow. And when I bow that time, it seemed like something just pulled all my clothes off. And I stood there and I talked to God. I said, God, I am really bad. I'm stealing from you now. You send these people here who have sold everything they have to serve you. And I'm stealing from your people. Help me. I really don't want to do this no more. And from that day to this day, I'm cognizant of my thief mentality. And I don't want, God has really delivered me from that. But I can say this to say that in order to work this program, I have to be into action of not working it for God to show me. And that's what I like about Alcoholics Anonymous and integrating the steps in my life on a daily basis. God shows me who I am and who this program is making me into. I couldn't have thought about being what God is making me. I'm just so grateful. And it's because my sponsor gave me some rules to follow. She taught me how to get close to God. And the big book says, if I do those things and draw close to God, he discloses himself to us. And God doesn't disclose me to me all of a sudden. He gives me just as much as I can take one day at a time. And because of that, Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a new life. I don't want the old life back. AA has given me a new life and a new freedom. And to this day, when I stand here and tell you all about this, I don't want to close the door on the past. I want that door open as wide as God will open it so I can keep seeing me. And every day that I'm sober in this program, God shows me more and more of me. Because I'm 15 years sober, I have not arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't think there will ever be a day when I arrive. I just love the beauty of working this program into my life every day of my life, one day at a time. And for that, I'm truly grateful. Thanks for having me share.